I don't know what's going on with my phone. Okay, buenas tardes. Estamos de vuelta con el podcast Café con César, después de muchísimo tiempo. Les habla su host, César Paradisi. Hoy tengo un invitado internacional para empezar con el primer episodio de esta temporada. Su nombre es Steve Cobb. Él es el fundador y uno de los encargados de una asociación norteamericana basada en el estado de Virginia, en Estados Unidos, la cual ayuda a la gente que sufre de cáncer a tratarlos con ayuda, digamos, personalizada para los casos de tumores cerebrales y otro tipo de cáncer, los cuales pueden ser tratados no solamente en el ámbito de la neurociencia o neurocirugía, sino ellos hacen algo especial y único, algo que no había yo escuchado antes y lo cual me encantó la primera vez que lo escuché. Y esto se trata de la ayuda humana, la ayuda hacia la otra persona, digamos, cara a cara, contándoles su experiencia, ¿verdad? Y bueno, este podcast va a ser completamente en inglés, ya que el invitado solamente habla inglés, pero para aquellos que no hablen mucho el idioma, les pido disculpas de antemano y bueno, espero que disfruten este episodio. Okay, Steve. So that was the introduction. I introduced you in Spanish, and I'm gonna
thank you, my friend.
introduce you in English as well. We are live recording this for Instagram Live, and we are recording as well on our platform here. That's gonna go live right after we're done recording the episode.
Wonderful.
So I want to thank you so much for letting me record this podcast to start off with my project. So,
I need to be thanking you because you were helping to get the word out about Cord of Three Strands.
Thank you so much, really. Yeah, and I'm very interested on what you do, really. Since I met you this past week and we became friends for life now.
Very fast friends.
Very fast friends.
You have helped me so much, not knowing very much Spanish and acting as a translator.
It's my pleasure.
And the conference the other day, I've shared this with you, but it gave me so much more confidence to know that somebody I could trust was doing the technical.
Right. I'm glad. I'm very glad. Yes. And, I'm, you know, always there for you. And for when help's needed, you know, I'm like Batman without the signal. Caesar. With a Caesar salad signal, and I'll be there.
That's right. We were speaking the other day. We have something in common. Both of us have salads named after us.
That's right.
Caesar has, of course, the Caesar salad, and I have the Cobb salad after me.
Which is great. A great salad as well. I love that. And Steve, so you have this foundation called Cord of Three Strands, right?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the foundation itself?
Yes, I can. First of all, the name of our group, and we are what's called a 501c3, which is an IRS, Internal Revenue Service, designation as a nonprofit. And we were very thrilled to be able to get that status. And the reason why is we don't ever charge the people who we work with. Donations come from friends and family and acquaintances of our friends and family. So we've been really blessed to have so much financial support as we have had. The name was something I'd always wanted to have an organization with this name. The name Cord of Three Strands comes from the Old Testament. The book of Ecclesiastes, which tradition has it, King Solomon, in his wisdom, wrote in his old age to give life advice.
Okay.
It's actually from Ecclesiastes 4:12, which reads, "While one is defenseless, two can defend one another. A cord of three strands is not easily or quickly broken."
Wow.
And that's so true, because any rope that you see, from the smallest one to the largest one that holds a large ship,
right,
they always have three strands. We are so excited. Did that answer your question?
It did. Okay. It actually did. Please keep going.
Okay. We're so excited. And the work that we're doing has been multiplied beyond anything we ever could have asked or imagined. And one of the ways that it has multiplied is the fact that we have begun receiving invitations from medical groups in other countries.
Okay.
So we have been traveling pretty extensively, and we also have three invitations coming up, one that was just received day before yesterday, to go to Brazil sometime in the first or second week of November.
Yeah, you told me about that. November. That's great, actually.
Yeah, so we're very excited about that. One of the reasons we're so excited about, there's an expression, if you give someone a fish, you feed them for a day.
Right.
If you teach them to fish, you feed them
for a lifetime.
And we are so excited. My board, I've got the most wonderful board in the world, three very good friends who have three very distinct gifts, which is what you really have to have. You don't want to replicate gifts. We have one who is a great technical guy. We have one who's a retired pastor who is so gifted at writing thank you letters and offering encouragement. And we have a veterinarian who has been so great about providing support. Jay is a very enthusiastic Christian.
Okay.
And our ministry is, of course, faith-based, but we work with multitudes of faith. We have a number of Jewish people we work with. We have some Hindu people we work with.
You have people from all over the world.
From all over. About a dozen agnostics, which are those who are not sure whether God exists or not, and some out-and-out atheists, who are pretty extreme atheists, which has been such a blessing to me because I didn't realize in my years in ministry what a bubble ministers operate within. If you're at a worship service, you're going to have all Christians that you're preaching a message to. If you're in your office, you're not going to have anyone but Christians coming into your office. When you're visiting people, you're visiting members of the congregation or their friends. An enclosed space that I really didn't realize how enclosed until I started doing this. What we're doing now is traveling all over the world, though, with the purpose of presenting what we are doing to medical groups and asking for invitations to come back to actually teach people what we are doing. Now, there are three attributes somebody has to have to be able to do what we're doing. That is, they have to have had cancer. They have to be 5 years beyond their prognosis.
Right.
In other words, if they've been told by doctors they have 3 to 5 years left to live, they have to be 10 years out from the cancer diagnosis and also have plenty of energy and stamina and excitement to be living their lives. In other words, a very optimistic outlook. Because what we're doing is we're coming alongside people who are stressed out, afraid, and typically very angry.
Okay.
And the anger is universally focused on God.
I agree.
Why me? Why am I going to have to miss my son's graduation? Why am I going to have to miss my daughter's wedding? Why am I not going to be able to see grandchildren when they come into the world? And why has my life been altered to this point where it's going to be shortened so dramatically?
So, I mean, when you tell me about this and I see it this way, I mean, it was really touching to hear about the experiences of people that suffer from a terrible disease such as cancer. And when they get the news, you know, this must be, you were a survivor for more than 30, what years?
Coming up on 30 years.
30 years, which is unbelievably amazing. And me personally, I'm so glad that you are with us here because you are such a great person, an example of, you know, accomplishment in life, and you know what it is to you know, have an experience like this, overcome that experience, and not everybody would be willing to teach others about it and to help them overcome that such a, you know, bad experience that they go through.
Yes. I now count people look at me like I've gone crazy or insane when I say this, but I actually look at my cancer as now as being one of the greatest blessings in my life. The fact that I have survived this feeds right in to the approach that we have, which I tell people, a lot of people conflate these two words, but you have sympathy and then you have empathy.
Right.
Now, anyone with a good heart can sympathize with someone who has been in a terrible automobile accident or who has had a spouse die or God forbid, has had a child die. Anyone with sympathy can relate to that or support people in that or feel bad for people in that. But to truly have empathy, and literally the word empathy means to suffer inside someone's suffering, you have to have
to relate.
Right. To have any kind of credibility, validity, to be able to understand what somebody is going through, who is going through chemotherapy, which is so debilitating. I mentioned the other day at this neurosurgical conference that a good day for me often was being able to get out of bed and sit in a chair close to the bed. The first time I went through chemotherapy, there were times I actually slept on the bathroom floor.
Wow.
Because I knew I was going to be sick. And I knew that when that nausea came over me, even with the bed being 20 feet maybe from the bathroom, that there were times I wouldn't be able to make it. So I slept right next to the toilet.
Wow.
Not often, but several times at least. Yes. Let me get back to 1 minute. There are two other attributes for somebody to do what I'm doing.
Okay.
They have to have a long history of working one-on-one with people because that's what we do. It's strictly one-on-one. There are small groups for cancer patients, but the small usually means anywhere from 8 to as many as 20 people.
Okay.
The power of what we do, working with people one-on-one, is there's an expression in the United States, and I think, you know, in many other countries, that everyone has a skeleton in their closet.
A skeleton in their closet, that's right.
And usually it's more like skeletons in their closet.
Skeletons, many.
Yes, many.
Many.
That they feel so guilty about, and the guilt, and the stress, and the anxiety, and the anger are all negative emotions that serve to drive people down.
Right.
To the point where it shortens your life. If you're diagnosed as having, or prognosed as having 3 to 5 years left to live, and you allow yourself to become consumed, which is really very easy to do.
Oh, totally,
with a
yeah.
cancer diagnosis.
I bet most people do.
Yes.
If you put it on a statistic, most people would get, I would get angry myself.
Yes.
You know, because they tell you, as you said before, like, how am I going to do this? Or one of the other questions that I think it's very important, like how, for the people that don't have the resources, if they get a diagnosis of having cancer, like if you didn't have, you know, the monetary, you know, stability,
right,
to pay for the treatment, that's even worse.
Exponentially, that adds to the level of stress, to the level of fear.
To everything.
Not being able to afford the treatment.
For the treatment.
And medical treatment, I'm here to tell you, is very, very, very expensive. Yes. Yes.
I bet it is.
Yes.
So, like, that's one of the things I always, like, you can see it in movies. There's many movies, countless movies about this, about treatment, about, I don't know if you've seen this movie with Cameron Diaz. But cancer is like one of her daughters gets cancer.
No, I have not seen
and
that.
And they have to pay for the whole treatment. Well, the movie is so powerful and touching that there's a period or a time on the movie that her daughter gets so sick and about this. She also remember, like you said, you experienced it, has to sleep like right next to the toilet. All her hair went gone.
Yes,
it's gone. Her
yes.
hair. She didn't want to use a wig. You know, her emotions in that movie go all, you know, the stakes of the movie goes up.
Yes.
So much. But what I wanted to say with this is Cancer is, if not the worst of all, I don't know.
I believe it is the worst because it is, you have so much time to think about dying.
About dying.
With something like a heart attack, it's sudden.
It's sudden, okay.
You're not going through the process
of the pain.
And the pain of the cancer consuming.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing to think about. Yeah. The pain, because, and also they tell you, most of the cases, they give you a period of time, expectation.
Yes.
Of time.
Yes.
So how can you deal with that?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So can you please tell me, Steve, about the people that you speak with are diagnosed with or they have the prognosis of cancer? How do they overcome this? Because we know there's the neuroscience, all that, you know, that scientific side of it. And what really is interesting about what you do is that people have been able to feel better.
Yes. Yes.
Than ever with what you do.
One of the many blessings of what I've been through is this, and I mentioned it at the conference the other day, but when I was first diagnosed, they thought I had something called a glioblastoma, which is the worst of the worst. It usually takes people out within 12 months.
My God.
So they told me that I was going to be dead within a year. And, you know, thank goodness... they were very wrong. Had a second opinion, third opinion, and so forth, but found a doctor, a very brilliant doctor, who was willing to take a chance and operate, Dr. Alan Friedman at Duke University, who, when he operated and the biopsy was done, it was not a glioblastoma. It's something called an anaplastic oligodendroglioma.
Wow.
Which is a slower growing cancer. And typically, well, the statistic is this, 80% who have my kind of cancer, it takes them, they die within 5 years. 100% of people who have my type of cancer are dead within 10 years. I'm approaching 30 years at this point. I don't know why.
You're over the limit.
I'm three times over
three
the
times
limit
over
right
the limit.
Now. I don't know why, even my doctors at this point don't know why I'm still here.
But, are you like a rare case to them?
Well, you know, the statistic is 100%, and 100% means 100%. It means
right.
Everyone it takes within 10 years.
10 years.
So because I've been out 30, it's more like 99.99999%. But I, for some reason, I'm definitely the outlier. And I credit that not to myself, but to God and His blessing on my life. I was a pastor for a number of years, and I loved being a pastor. But right now, I look back on that as a warm up,
right?
As a warm up to be able to know how to speak with people one to one, as a warm up of being a good listener, and mainly as a warm up to be hyper confidential. Even my board doesn't know the names of the people that I work with, and they're not interested in knowing the names of the people that I work with. But that has made the ministry all the more powerful, the fact that I was first diagnosed with the glioblastoma, the worst of the worst. So the first 2 or 3 years, I thought I had a glioblastoma. It took a while to find a surgeon who was willing to operate. But to live through that helps me so much in speaking
right.
with people who actually do have glioblastomas, in understanding what goes through your mind emotionally,
right.
spiritually, mentally. Doctors do a wonderful job, and the skill level of neurosurgeons is off the charts, of neurologists, of oncologists, of radiologists. All very fine people
very
who
fine
are
people.
Very skilled.
Yeah, we have here very good ones in Mendoza, in Argentina.
Yes, yes.
Luckily. And
let me just finish a
yes,
thought.
Yeah.
They deal strictly with the physical. So
physical.
once they get through, they send people out who are emotional wrecks, who are, you know, the mental aspect of I'm still only have 6 months left to live or a year left to live. And the emotions that I've already mentioned, being completely stressed out, being so anxious, all of the negative emotions. There was a study done that was several decades long by a British group of doctors on the effects of stress on the human body. And the result was that having so much stress is as bad on the human body physically as smoking cigarettes.
And for sure,
we all know how bad smoking cigarettes.
I didn't know the results of this, but once I thought of myself, I mean, not compared to smoking cigarettes, but I said it's stress is one of the worst things that, you know, you can think of or have. I mean, let me give you a brief example getting out of, you know, the subject. But when I was in the States, I met this guy from my from Cuba, this Cuban guy. He was a doctor in Cuba, in La Habana. And his face was all red, and he had like pimples, and you know, it looks like something really bad happened to him. But it's not like he was born with that. I don't know if I can explain myself right, but he like you can tell that he suffered from something.
Yes,
I don't know.
Yes.
And speaking with him, he told me that. On the process of leaving Cuba, he didn't do it like the other people. Like, he didn't took a boat and just went to Florida. But instead, he went all the way through Central America, down to Mexico. And this is to resume the story, but he got kidnapped in Mexico by some gang or something. And they would punch him. And close him in a place, and they would call his relatives and ask him for $20,000, and all the stress that he was suffering by that time.
Yes.
made him suffer from this skin reaction and internal reactions on his blood, on his system, that of not knowing what are you gonna do, how are you gonna deal with the situation, because you're not prepared for it mentally or
right.
physically.
Right.
So coming back to the topic of stress, I think it is really bad for the system and life itself.
It is. It completely breaks down your immune system. It manifests itself in many ways. One of the ways is with skin conditions
right.
that people, you know, it's obviously they can see. There are other ways it manifests itself also in just weakening your body. You're no longer able. If you're stressed out, it saps your strength. It saps your endurance.
Totally, I agree.
If you used to be able, say, to run 3 miles and you're stressed out, you'd be fortunate to be able to run a half a mile or a mile at the most
mm-hmm.
because that's the way it manifests itself. It's deadly. It's deadly. And one of the things that we try to do is show people how deadly it is. We don't come right out and say it. The ministry that we have, other than the first session that we have with people, is mostly a listening ministry.
Listening, okay.
It's been said that 90% of caring for someone is just showing up, just being a presence in their life, someone willing to listen to them. The people I work with run the gamut from weeping the entire time we're together to pounding the table because they're so angry.
They're so angry.
And everything in between.
Okay.
Everything in between.
And you're used to this because you know the feeling.
I'm used to that because I know the feeling.
Right.
I was very angry. I went through, and my parents can tell you this, I went through the why me stage
where I
was angry.
Right.
Angry at God.
At everything, at whatever.
Right. When I was diagnosed, I wasn't married. I had no children. There was this emptiness that came with knowing that I was going to die. I was convinced I was going to die. Without leaving any children, and children are our legacy.
Yeah.
No matter how important we are, no matter how many wings of how many hospitals or how many buildings on university campuses have our name on it for wealthy people, you die and
your
distant
children.
Memory, right. You have got to have children to carry on your name, to continue having an impact for good in the world. So that was one of the first things that I thought is, you know, I am going to die childless. I'm going to be forgotten. the book of James and the Bible ask the question, what is our life? And his answer to that is our lives are a mist. In other words, we're here now and we're gone.
Wow.
And you consider the human lifespan, yeah, which in the United States is, you know, maybe 76 years. But 76 years compared to eternity is
nothing.
An instant.
Yeah.
Is an instant.
Wow. Yes. Yeah, you see life pass right by your eyes.
Yes.
And I want to keep talking about the patience.
Okay.
Because when you start talking to them, like you said, how do you call it? It's just by listening.
Listening
to what you have to say, to offer. And it would, like, putting myself or trying to put myself in the shoes of one of the patients by being there, it must be so tough. Why I say this? Because you are at this place that I really appreciate exists, the Court of Three Strands. Because, you know, sometimes in life, and I say it personally,
mm-hmm,
family, sometimes, in some cases, it's not there for you.
Yes.
It's not there for you.
Yes.
You would want them to be there for you, but they're not. Why? Because everybody, I guess, have their own issues and stuff, but I'm referring to, like, normal life situation.
Right.
They're not there for you. Imagine if you have cancer and your family is not there for you.
Yes.
That must be so, so tough.
Yes.
To, you know, go through. And so that's why you are here. You know,
yes.
I think it's very important to acknowledge what you do, what's your mission, and what the people you contribute with do with others and to others to help them. And you were talking to me about, I think, a group of people that you started working with, and they have overcome this.
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that, please?
Yes. First of all, I want to say that I did not have that family experience. My family really rallied around.
Right.
Really rallied around. My parents.
That's good.
Were really incredible.
I mean, you were lucky.
They were the ones who were seeking second and third and fourth opinions, and they would tell me, and, you know, I would go to the appointments with them. But my parents just grabbed this and ran with it. They were so determined to find somebody that,
right,
they would do the surgery. And I would not be here now if they hadn't found,
I mean, that,
Alan
that, that,
Friedman.
As they should, as you said, I mean, you are their son, and,
yes,
and that's, you are their legacy, and therefore they need to do anything on their power to help you and, you know, seek for your well-being. That's
right,
it.
Right. But there are a lot of family structures that were
don't
the way
work
that you
as well.
Presented.
Don't work as well.
One of the things that is very common,
yes,
not completely universal, but very common, is when you're diagnosed with cancer, you know, you start looking bad, and, you know, the treatment takes all of your hair, and it's so obvious that you have cancer. Even your friends and sometimes your family members, when they have a conversation with you, they avoid talking about the cancer. They'll talk about the weather. They'll talk about local sports teams. They'll talk about politics. They'll
anything
come back to the weather again.
Oh, my God.
And for people who have cancer, you all, they want to talk about the cancer. They need to talk about the cancer. There's nothing wrong with asking people how they are feeling,
right,
how they're dealing with their cancers. As a matter of fact, that's very therapeutic for someone who has cancer.
Yeah, they release what they feel.
They release what they feel.
Okay.
And they really need to do that. Because if you bottle everything up, it's so much worse.
Yeah.
It contributes to, it will take
to
you out faster than
the
you
negativity,
would
have, the stress.
Right, all of those things.
You, I mean, it's not like you have to go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I think personally, just by talking to someone, in this case, talking to you one-to-one or to a friend or a family member about how you feel with the cancer, must be a release. It's like in church when you confess, sort of,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And that's one of the things our ministry is based on, is the ability. I started talking about the small groups that are available, and you mentioned, you know, right now we've got psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists who are available, but they can't empathize. Some of them can because some of them have had cancer.
Right.
But they also charge a fee.
No way.
And if you want to go to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or a therapist, you are going to pay.
You're going
to
pay
at the end of your time with them. We never charge a fee of anyone that we speak with.
I mean, I think personally, my opinion is it's wrong to charge, because I'm not going to say they do it just for the money. I mean, they need to eat at the end of the day.
Right.
But the person that's paying for this service, as a lawyer or a doctor, you know, is their time that they're putting in. But you would feel so much better just to have someone that is willing to listen to you and how you feel.
Right. And not doing it for the money.
And not doing it for the money, exactly.
And you're right. You know, psychiatrists, psychologists have to have an income to, you know, to feed their families,
right,
to keep a roof over their families' heads, to feed their families. But in the small group context, a small group is usually anywhere from 6 to 20 people. If you have cancer and you come into a small group filled with strangers,
mm-hmm,
and you confess things that you're guilty about, you're never sure, and rightfully so, you're never sure whether as soon as they leave that room that the meeting is in, they're not going to go out and say, hey, a new guy named Joe came in today, and he embezzled money from his company 20 years ago, or he cheated on his wife multiple times throughout his life.
Wow.
In other words, adultery, embezzlement, and many other crimes and misdemeanors,
misdemeanors.
That we work with. People are not comfortable in groups. The biggest sin discussed in the Bible, and this is a lot in the book of James also, is the sin of gossip.
Gossip. Yeah.
Gossip is the number one sin that's mentioned in all of the Bible. Having me to talk to, knowing that it's going to always and forever be confidential. And also being able to unload this baggage. Roman Catholic Church obviously has confession, where you go in and confess your sins. The difference is I don't tell people, you know, to do 4 Hail Marys and 2 Our Fathers when they tell me what they've done. And it's also in, you know, people go to confession so often in the Roman Catholic Church that it's almost like sometimes they're making things up. You know, I parked in a handicap spot. I didn't. I got incorrect change for my meal at McDonald's,
right,
and didn't point it out to the person, you know, behind the counter.
Yeah,
they gave me too much money back. You know, kind of smallish things,
right?
Rather, you know,
but they're small. But they it's on the back of their heads.
Yes.
And they can live with that.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't matter what you did,
yeah,
like anything. So you have to release all that information.
Right.
Because you know inside of your head that's wrong.
Yeah, you do.
And do you happen to, I mean, you're not going to tell them to pray or anything like that, but do you tell them to do something at home? Or give them like an exercise?
What we do is this, and I'm so glad you asked that question, Caesar. Cancer patients tend, for good or for bad,
okay,
if they have a social activity, like a golf game, a weekly golf game,
right,
or a weekly bridge game, or have people that they go jogging with every
jogging
other day,
with.
The tendency when you're diagnosed with cancer is to
draw back,
not play golf with your friends anymore, not go running with your friends, not playing cards with your friends. Which is, all of those things are harmful. And it gets even worse because in your family unit, depending on your age, your parents or your children or your spouse, people who have cancer think they're doing a service to their family by keeping everything bottled up, not sharing with your wife or your husband or your children or your parents how you're feeling. What you're going through, whether you're having a really bad day that, you know, you feel like you're going to throw up the entire day. In other words, you go into a cocoon.
Right.
Or a bubble.
Bubble.
Which is the worst
of emotions,
thing.
Of everything.
Exactly.
Thoughts.
Exactly.
And besides, like, already having this disease, and people talking about it. You probably, I don't know if maybe you saw this, but these are things that I like imagine would happen. Like, it would be terrible if someone gets diagnosed and, I don't know, in a couple months, you're like on a family reunion as usual or whatever, but you're sitting by yourself thinking about anything or the disease, and you could see your relatives talking about you on the corner or not saying anything, like you said, about the disease. And that's just very because it drags you down.
It does.
It drags you down, and it's not right.
It's very draining because you come to think and see that everyone else is carrying on a normal life.
Right.
They're talking about maybe a grandchild or a child who is pregnant, you know, about to have a child, you know, so excited to become a grandparent. And you're sitting there, you know, steeping in your own negative emotions. I'm never going to have a grandchild. I'm not going to live long enough to have a grandchild. All of these negative things that when we come alongside people, and I do not want to pretend or overstate or exaggerate how quickly it happens, but slowly over the course of time, those negative, terrible, debilitating emotions and attitudes are replaced through optimistic type attitudes. In other words, being grateful, you know, for this day, this beautiful day.
For breathing, for life.
Right, for breathing.
I don't know, for being free.
Right. Being free, you know, in society, and to...
To have three meals a day.
Yes.
To being able to anything. I mean,
right.
I think just to, you know, to put this on the table, per se, not only by... You don't need to have a disease such as cancer. And this is like a message I want to give to people, you know? And it's like, you have to already, you don't have to go through these bad moments in your life. Of course, these bad moments in your life will make you think about it and think about the things you have and make you appreciate those things.
Right.
But if you haven't been through those times, you should also, you know, think about and appreciate what you already have. You know, you don't have to be bragging about anything or thinking you're the best.
Right.
Because you're not.
Right.
You're just a... There's a doctor that I happened to meet with Dr. Alejandro also at the N20 back in November. And this guy, he has a lot of money. He is an inventor as well of machinery for the hospitals and microscopes and stuff.
Right.
He's a personality, and he's one of the, you know, more down to earth people I've met in my life. And he said, I remember because I used to help him walk through the city in Buenos Aires, and he used to tell me this every time. He said, "Caesar, no one is better than anybody."
Yes.
Nobody's better than anybody. Some people know this, and I need that, and that's not really what matters in life.
Right.
So what would be an advice from you?
Well, cancer is really a great equalizer. When you're diagnosed with cancer, your priorities completely change.
Right.
You know, people who are chasing after money, chasing after getting third or fourth car and building a garage to accommodate those cars... having a big house, going to very special, expensive places on vacation.
Right.
All of those things disappear. And the things that are truly important are realized. Things like relationships that you have within your family.
Within your family.
The friends who love you, who you're so blessed to be with.
Yeah.
There is a quote in the Bible or a verse in the Bible, 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. The love of money is the root of all evil. It's not money itself. Money is an inanimate object, but it's the development of love for money that's the root of all evil. With a cancer diagnosis, those things disappear. Your entire life is turned upside down. And lots in a negative way. No, nobody I've ever met wants to have cancer. Nobody wants to have cancer. But the blessing of a diagnosis like that is it turns everything around. You're allowed to realize the things that are truly important. You know, the support systems that you have, the hobbies that you love so much that somehow you become such a workaholic to support everything else
right.
that you're no longer taking the time to do. That's why we really encourage people to re-socialize.
Re-socialize.
And one of the things that that's one of the benefits or one of the achievements that Court of Three Strands has, people go back out and start playing golf. They realize how much they enjoy that, and they're robbing themselves of the enjoyment. Or, you know, going running with some friends or playing cards with some friends, as I mentioned earlier. But all of those things switch around. And that's one of the great things that brings joy back into someone's life and gratitude into someone's life, is just pointing out to them how important it is to continue being with your friends, how important, very important, primary importance is paying attention to your family, loving your children, loving your parents, and the fact that they love you in return.
Right.
is such a great blessing that so many people begin to take for granted as they get older. Working so hard that they never see their kids, being distant from their parents and never making an effort to get together with their parents. The family system is the friend system,
mm-hmm.
is so critical in this.
It is.
You have a safety net, and people need a safety net when they have cancer. They need to know that the people who love them
are there for them.
Which is so critically important, that they're not a free agent, that they're not an entity unto themselves. Now, this is pretty much universal also. I used to think it was just the United States, but as I've started traveling and realizing that these movies are translated into other language, but depending on your age, you are told by Hollywood, men especially, are told by Hollywood
to be tough.
Whether you're of the generation of John Wayne or Clint Eastwood or Bruce Willis, Hollywood puts out the message that if you ever ask for help, that you're not really a man. And that
could
not be further from the truth.
That is very interesting, Steve, because I've met people my age, I mean, in this case, men my age, that still, in the year 2019... behave that way, and you know it's sad because they do it by default. They don't do it because they want to be like that. It's their parents, or in this case their father, Hollywood, society, a magazine, it doesn't matter.
Right.
The message is coming from somewhere. You are absorbing the message, and because we are like sponge.
Yes.
We absorb information, and this information we can either take it for good or for bad.
Right.
Or we can use it for a benefit or whatever. So with this you're saying of being tough as a man, and this is I'm saying this because I saw an interview of a very prestigious actor, Hollywood actor. His name is Michael B. Jordan. I don't know if you're
yes.
related. He did the Creed movies with Sylvester Stallone.
Right.
And I saw the other day an interview with Oprah of him saying that when he was filming the movie Black Panther, which is the antagonist in that movie, he had to, in order to get in character for that role, he had to get away from his family and friends for a long period of time. And this is like 8 months. Away from social media,
wow.
away from his friends, away from getting out, hanging out, away from his family. And he did really got into character because that's how the character was like. He filmed the movie. Everything was great. And then he says that a couple weeks after, months after, he started feeling lonely. And, I mean, he wasn't suffering from a disease, but it kind of is. It's all in your mind.
Right.
And it's like psychology kind of right. stuff. And he says that sometimes he would just be by himself in his house, and he would have he would come up with suicidal thoughts of maybe killing
right.
himself.
Right.
Why? Because all the period of time he had without talking to his relatives and his friends, just like drag him down, obviously for the role, which worked,
right.
but he didn't know what to do. So he went to a specialist, he talked to someone, and on that interview with Oprah, he said that men tend like this, to be a macho man, you know, a strong force, and I don't need to seek help from nobody. I got it, woman. I got it. You know
yes.
all this and
yes.
like simple stuff like I can change the lamp
yes.
or you know those things. That's not true.
Right.
We as we are men. We are human beings. Like I'm saying this myself, and I cry. I'm a human being.
Yes.
I cry.
And
I have the
so
right
important.
To cry. Crying doesn't make me less. Of a man, you know, I have emotions.
It actually makes you a fuller man.
It makes me a fuller man because
yes.
I acknowledge that I am a human being, and I have feelings, and I can feel bad at times, and I cry.
Yes.
When they tell you, "Man, don't cry," it's like,
yes.
"What are you talking about?"
Right.
We do cry,
right.
and a lot. That doesn't make me less than anybody else. I mean, and that it's all connected.
It is.
You know why? Because a man who doesn't cry, who still wants to cry
yes.
inside of him, he is taking all that emotion and put it in a box, per se, an example, and keeping it there forever. He's enclosing himself into an abyss
yes.
of emotions
yes.
that he is going to take him a long time. Or sometimes he's never gonna be able to release them all because of what we're talking about. Like, I have to be a man forever.
Yes.
I don't need to seek help from no one, and I am good.
Yes.
And this is not true.
That is not true. Two of my favorite historical figures are the Apostle Paul, who spent his life spreading the gospel. You know, people think he was, you know, such a hard-ass kind of guy. He was very brilliant. But in his life, he went through so much.
Yeah.
And in the book of 2 Corinthians, he talks about everything that he's gone through. He's been shipwrecked. He's been given 40 lashes minus one, which was the 40 lashes was synonymous with being beaten to death. He'd been beaten that hard multiple times. He was exposed to bandits. He was exposed to the weather. You know, he was crossing deserts to deliver the good news. In modern terms, the picture I get, you know, when Paul's writing these things,
right.
is that he's in the fetal position under the couch or under a bed
right.
and not able to take another step. He's exhausted. He's worn out. He's through.
It's true.
And he has this wonderful vision of Christ. And Christ says to him, you can do this. You can go on. And Paul comes out of that vision knowing and saying and writing, it is when I am weak that I am strong. Because when
wow.
you are weak, you realize that you need help, that you need the support of other people, and that your faith becomes so much more important. And Paul pointed that out. You know, Paul was a really strong guy, a really tough guy. Maybe even the John Wayne of his day.
Sure.
But he realized in doing all of these and all of the things that he had to go through that he was not an entity unto himself. You mentioned something earlier or a few minutes ago that reminded me of another figure that I'd like to talk about. Søren Kierkegaard.
Okay.
The Danish gadfly, the philosopher.
The philosopher, yeah.
Wrote many books. One of my favorites that he wrote is a book called Sickness Unto Death. You were talking about Michael B. Jordan earlier.
Michael B. Jordan.
And him isolating himself.
Right.
Well, that book is about someone in prison who has been put into solitary confinement.
My God.
And the effects that that has on this prisoner, the sickness,
right?
The sickness of being isolated. We are meant, we are created to live in community.
In community, yeah, for sure.
You cannot become an entity unto yourself. And that's what Kierkegaard's talking about. He's talking about that it would be kinder to have put somebody to death than to isolate them in solitary confinement. About the mental things that go through that, the emotional things, the breakdown of your physical body, because holistically you are slowly drained of life.
Right.
By being by yourself. You don't have people to talk to.
You
start talking to yourself. You don't have people to share your joys or
Let's say you lose it.
Yes.
You lose it. You lose your mind.
Yes.
You don't exist anymore.
Yes.
Because you're living community.
Exactly.
There's no way to, you know, make something out of your life.
Right. And the cancer diagnosis is very similar to that, because slowly, with the emotions, the negative emotions you're having or feelings or your mental state, you are slowly,
isolating
yourself and thus dying faster than you would have otherwise. I mentioned at the conference day before yesterday that in the first year we existed, we're coming up on 5 years now, first year we existed, we had 15 people who had been told that they were down to their last 3 months. And boy, did they look it. They were sapped of energy. They could barely get out of a chair. And I'm just so pleased. That's one of the great successes that we've had, is we're coming up on 5 years, and all 15 of those people are still here, still with us, because of the fact that we have been able to rid them of the negative emotions, of the way that they've isolated themselves, and to re-socialize them, to point out to them their importance of, like I mentioned, family and friends and continuing activities that gave them such great joy before the diagnosis. And they take that joy away from themselves. They stop interacting with their friends. They even, like I mentioned earlier, isolate themselves from their own families, which is so life-creating. It's what Kierkegaard was talking about in being in solitary confinement. It's a self-imposed solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement.
Right.
That's another interesting piece of advice there that I want you to give to the audience, related to what Jesus did in that story.
Yes.
And let me try to put this together.
Okay.
In your family and friends, when you're suffering from a disease like this, and this is to take from the story, Jesus trying to be like a savior for the world, in this case for him.
Yes.
And don't you think that there has to be, just saying, there has to be a Jesus, but to put it in the context of a family member, a friend, in this case, you with your foundation, to be there to help you not to get stuck in isolation?
Yes.
So my question is, or it's more an advice that I want you to give, is to the people that maybe have a relative or friend that are suffering from cancer, or maybe not suffering from a disease, but just not feeling well. Because sometimes I don't happen to feel well.
Yes.
With what am I doing with my life, or, you know, anything, or my relationships.
Right.
So what would you advise the audience with?
Right. Well, I distinguished between two terms earlier, sympathy and empathy.
Sympathy is so important.
It is so important. I did not mean that sympathy was not important. People with good hearts are able to sympathize with someone who has cancer, someone who has been told they have 6 months left to live or a year left to live. The important thing for the family and friends is not to fall into the pattern of engaging someone who has cancer and never talking about the cancer, never allowing the person to vent about their cancer or to share their cancer, to rid themselves of the emotions that they're having, to know that they have somebody to speak to. I mentioned earlier, you know, 90% of caring for someone is just being there.
Just being there for them.
To talk to them.
Company.
Right. To comfort them. And sympathy is so comforting because the person knows they have people who care for them. The deeper care is empathy. Being able to speak from experience, like I mentioned about, you know, how awful chemotherapy makes you feel. The goal of chemotherapy is to kill. And hopefully
to kill the
it
cancer.
Kills the cancer before it kills the cancer's host.
Right.
I know people who chemotherapy, well, I did know people who chemotherapy proved fatal for them. It weakened them so much that they were unable to recover
wow.
from having the chemo treatment. But, you know, going back to the Apostle Paul and his vision of Jesus, saying to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness." None of us can be Jesus, but we can play the role of Jesus.
That's what I meant. Play the role of Jesus in order to, you know, help a friend to
yes.
overcome his disease or a very tough moment in their lives.
Right, right. And that's so critically important. You know, for those of you listening who don't have cancer, but have a friend who has cancer, it is so important not only that you continue seeing them, but that you up your game, that you see them more frequently than you used to see them,
right.
that you're there for them to lean on, that you're there to make them feel better, knowing that they have such a powerful friend or family member who is so interested, who is so concerned in what they're going through, that they're willing to do anything for them, you know, to cross deserts for them, to, this is metaphorically,
yeah.
but, you know, to do anything that needs to be done, bring them food. You know, when people don't have family units, it's even more important to bring them dinner, to show that you care for them, to offer to clean their house, to offer to drive them to doctor's appointments. All of those things make someone with cancer so much more upbeat, knowing that they have this great safety net of people
right.
who care for them, who love them. And when you're diagnosed with cancer, that not only becomes more important to the person who has cancer, but it becomes more, they have a greater knowledge of it because they know that they need help and they know that people are willing to come in and support them and help them. It raises their, it just makes them so much more positive.
Right.
It raises their emotions. It makes them feel better.
Oh,
it
for
makes
sure.
them happier. It gives them joy. It makes them grateful to have those friends and family. Where before, often, as you're living your life, you start to take those relationships for granted. You know, when you're a child, you know that you need your mother and your father. And you go and you knock on somebody's door and ask if they can come out to play, right? Well, we lose that when we become more mature.
Why is that?
Well, it's because the busyness of life comes in and takes over. You have bills to pay. You have things to do.
Well, yeah.
People become so consumed by the work that they have, which, like I mentioned earlier, once you're diagnosed with cancer, those things go away. You realize that, you know, working 60 or 70 hours a week and not seeing your wife or your children or your parents is not a fair trade. And it's not a good deal in any way, shape, or form. You become more appreciative of your family. I mentioned at the conference day before yesterday that chemotherapy is difficult and is excruciating and is nauseating as it is to go through. The silver lining behind that very dark cloud is this. The busyness of life disappears. You're no longer able to work. You're no longer having people calling you to ask you to do things, you know,
right.
whether it's your boss or a coworker. All of that disappears.
It's like you are unable to do the to to work for the world, to be you know what I mean, to be,
I do know what you mean,
to
have to feel like you're at the beck and call and available,
the beck and call, but also like you can do something, like you have the ability, it's like you're not more of use to help,
right?
But you need help now,
right?
And people need to empathize that.
Yes,
empathy is so important.
It is so important.
I really like that you use that word and apply it into what you do,
right?
Because I think empathy can save the world.
Yes, and it's so important. You know, one of the things that even people who know the Bible fairly well, you know, you read through the Bible, and as you read, you know, one scene and go on to another, you don't attach the strings together.
Right.
The entire Bible is a string that, you know, from Genesis to Revelation that ties together. And one of the aspects that's so important, and it's throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, is the importance of a common meal. You have Jesus, and we now have communion because of this, because of the Last Supper.
Right, Last Supper.
But the Last Supper wasn't the only supper. It was the Last Supper. Jesus was continually coming together with people, signifying the importance of community. Jesus, a lot of people forget that Jesus was both fully divine and fully human. You've got the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is so overwhelmed at the idea, and that he knows that he's going to be crucified. Luke portrays Jesus in Gethsemane, sweating. He's so overwrought, sweating as though drops of blood were hitting the ground. And Jesus actually asking God, will you please take this away from me? But then says, not my will, but thy will be done. But even Christ, you know, became overwrought. Jesus knew the importance of community and of dining together. Actually, the town Jesus was born in, Bethlehem,
okay,
translates in the Hebrew, lechem means bread, beit means house. So Bethlehem actually means house of bread.
House of bread. To feed the others.
Right, signifying the importance. The greatest miracles Jesus did that are in all four Gospels is the feeding of the 5,000, where bread and fish, a very meager amount of bread and fish,
right,
is utilized to feed everyone there, which was so important because they were out in the middle of the desert and wouldn't have been able to survive if they'd had to go to another town. The first miracle Jesus did in the Bible was the wedding at Cana, where they ran out of wine, right? They run out of wine. And Jesus turns water, not only into wine,
right,
but the finest wine. The steward comes up to him and he says, wait a minute, we usually serve the best wine first. And as people become intoxicated, we serve the bad wine after that. Jesus not only turned water into wine, but it was better wine,
the best wine,
than the banquet it started out with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, we got like 3 more minutes left, and we have talked about so many things.
Yes.
So so many important things. And I want you to, I'm going to give you like one more minute to send a message to the people of how could they help their friends,
right,
you know, and you know, just
right,
say
right,
whatever you think.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to do this, and what I'd like to start out doing is saying that we are really, really excited about the opportunity to travel to different countries to present and to teach,
yeah,
what we are doing. So those of you who are watching this right now, I would encourage you to get a hold of me. Our website is www.c3s.live, L-I-V-E.
I will be linking his information down at the podcast bio information, and also I'm going to be posting a picture of two of us on the Instagram page of the podcast with all the information regarding the website.
But what I would encourage folks to do, if you're, you know, debating or on the fence, as we say in the United States, I would encourage you to realize the importance of what we are doing and to realize that you can be a part of this, which is such a blessing to your friends, to your family members, to those who are suffering with cancer. And I use the word suffering intentionally. The tendency, as we have said, is isolation.
Isolation, yep.
Which is the worst possible thing you can do. Kierkegaard knew it with his figure of solitary confinement, mm-hmm. you know, slowly dying, being inside your own head, not
That's
having anybody
worst.
To talk to.
That's the worst.
It is the worst. You know, it's this vicious cycle. You start thinking, I'm going to die.
I think psychological pain is worse than physical pain.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And, you know, we see that in some of the tortures, that mm-hmm. you know, historic tortures. It doesn't hurt to have water dripped on you one drop at a time.
Right.
I'm talking about the Chinese water torture.
Chinese water.
It doesn't hurt you physically, but it breaks you down mentally. When is the next drop going to hit me? When is this going to end? So you're absolutely right about that. The mental, the emotional, is so much more painful than the physical.
Wow. Okay. So, Steve, I want to first thank you for allowing me to, you know, interviewing you here to also give me the opportunity to start my podcast from the beginning, because I started with this project around a year ago.
A year ago.
I made some episodes, but today, a year after, I can say that I feel proud of what I'm doing, and I feel thankful for the people that I have met. I feel thankful for meeting you, my friend. Really.
Not as thankful as I feel about meeting you, my friend.
For sure, for sure. And also, I want to tell the people to follow on all the social and also visit Steve's organization's website, the Court of Three Strands, which I will be linking on the Instagram. I'm going to be posting a picture of the two of us. And please empathize with people, with your friends, with your family, with your coworkers, with people you don't even know. Treat others well. And there's a saying that we have also everywhere, I think, that says treat others just like you would like to be treated.
Yes. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Exactly. And that is so important.
Yes.
Because if there's no reason to treat anybody bad or to do something bad to someone else, even if someone did something bad to you, don't repay them with the same medicine.
Yes.
Try to teach them
yes.
a good lesson, and they will learn something good.
Yes.
So I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast, and I want you to follow Steve on all his social platforms. And this is the first episode of Café con César. Gracias por escuchar este episodio del podcast. Espero que les haya gustado. Y bueno, los dejo para que tengan una bonita tarde en un domingo tal como hoy. Gracias.
Gracias.
Steve, por todo.
Dios le bendiga.
Dios te bendiga.